Hello, welcome to another edition of Stark Raven on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. Here on Stark Raven, we delve into issues of imprisonment and criminalization, and we air the first three Mondays of each month from 7 till 8 p.m. here on 102.7 FM, and our podcast is available anytime at prisonjustice.ca. I'm Emily Aspinwall, and I'm here with Tiffany Chong tonight. In the next hour, we bring you an interview with political prisoner and journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal. He's reflecting on the 40th anniversary of the creation of the Black Panther Party. In the news, we hear more on the latest moves by Justice Minister Vic Taves, including one of his latest plans that involves giving police a say in choosing judges, and also the bill he's hoping to introduce mandatory minimums. That bill is facing resistance in the Justice Committee. We'll also be hearing a report about a hunger strike on death row in Texas. All that and more is in our news section. And in the second half hour, we look at prisoners and their voting rights in Australia, Canada, and the United States. Find out more about the 2007 political prisoner calendar and other community announcements at the end of the show. And tonight's music will be featuring Montreal hip-hop collective Nomadic Massive. So stay tuned to Stark Raven in the next hour here on your community station, Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
October 16, 2006 will mark the 40th anniversary of the founding of the Black Panther Party by Minister of Defense Huey P. Newton and Chairman Bobby Seale in Oakland, California. The Block Report wanted to get the voice and reflections of one Black Panther who will be absent from the festivities. The world knows this man as political prisoner and journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal, who on December 9, 2006 will be spending his 25th year behind enemy lines on a trumped-up murder charge. Check out Mumia as he talks about his circumstances as well as his thoughts on the Black Panther Party 40 years later.
December 9th marks the 25th anniversary of the killing of Daniel Faulkner that Arnold Beverly confessed to and you were brought up on trumped up charges and convicted of. Do you have any comments on this violation of your human rights and miscarriage of justice?
Well, it's been 25 years of hell, 25 years of injustice, 25 years of false confessions, 25 years of judicial hatred, 25 years of jurors being removed because they're black, 25 years of living in a cell the size of a bedroom, 25 years of hell. I mean, you know, the struggle continues, but, you know, it ain't no shortchange for hell.
Yeah, no doubt. This October also marks the 40th anniversary of the Black Panther Party. Many of the veterans of the BPP have continued to do work in the community, while others have, quote-unquote, retired from the movement, although we're still fighting the same empire that the Panthers were against. What are your thoughts on this phenomenon?
Well, I have nothing but praise for those people who have continued to struggle in...
This call is from a correctional institution and is subject to monitoring and recording.
In various communities and various other organizations, you know, and they bring pride to the Black liberation struggle, but to their communities and to their people and to their history as well. I also don't kind of criticize those people who have retired because, you know, people can do what they feel compelled to do based on what they can do. This is the longest war in America. I think with the possible exception of the Indian Wars, you know, black people have been fighting for freedom as long as there's been an America before there was a United States of America. And it continues, you know, in many cities and many fronts in all areas of life. When I think about those 40 years, it's amazing that it's been 40 years. But now more than ever, I mean, when I look about black communities, whether east, west, south, or north, wherever, I see the need for something like the party, or at least somebody with the spirit of the party, to at least address the needs of the poorest and the least of these. I mean, when you look at the civil rights movement, that really addressed middle class people in many ways, you know, the jobs, the education, and what have you. But if you're poor and black in this country, in many ways, much has not changed. And in some sad ways, things have gotten, I think, progressively worse.
Observing this 40th anniversary of the founding of the Black Panther Party from behind enemy lines as a political prisoner, what kind of reflections do you have for the world?
Just like I said, I mean, you know, I'm reminded when I look back over the works of people like Angela Davis, who was writing in the early 70s, I think 72, 71 perhaps, in her autobiography, you know, she was a young woman, but worthy certainly of an autobiography, If They Come for Me in the Morning, that she was profoundly critical of the prison industrial complex in the 70s. And if you look at the population of prisons in the 70s and then look at it now, we literally have millions of people, perhaps 45-52% African American, an explosion in the imprisonment of black women. I mean, damn, you know, this place is far more pervasive than it was in the 1970s when we were talking about the imprisonment of a people. So things have, I think, gone from one level to a worse level.
In looking back over the four decades since the founding of the Black Panther Party, how do you feel about the media's portrayal of the organization then and now? And I'm talking about mainstream, black, and alternative media.
Well, we shouldn't be surprised that the bourgeois media will, for the most part, tend to denigrate the work of the party. That's their job. I mean, the party opposed this entire system in a way that few black organizations did at that time, at least with that kind of energy, pervasive attack. So, I mean, what do you expect the system to say? Oh, yeah, we're wrong. We've been wrong for 300-400 years, and we shouldn't treat, you know, black folks that way? No. It's going to respond through its cultural artists, through its own form of bourgeois propaganda. There are many people on the left who have also done extraordinary work to teach people of a later generation about the party, like the Black Panther Party Reconsidered. The book that was edited by Charles Jones is an extraordinary volume of work on women in the party, on the Black Panther newspaper, on its educational and survival programs, you name it. I mean, it's a storehouse of information. At the risk of sounding modest, my book, I think, also helps open up perspective. So,
this call is from a correctional institution and is subject to monitoring and recording.
So people have done work. The question is it being exposed to the people who need to read it, which are young people, young black people, young Puerto Rican people, especially young people, so they can know what was possible? We forget Huey P. Newton 40 years ago was 24 years old.
That brings me into my next question. Minister of Defense Huey P. Newton didn't live to see the 40th anniversary of the Black Panther Party, which he co-founded. What would you want people to remember about him?
When I think about him, I think about his extraordinary brilliance, his revolutionary audacity, his courage, his love for black people. I think, again, for a 24-year-old man to found that party was a remarkable thing. But I think that when you look at the wide swath of black life of that period, then there were people all across the country in small communities that we don't hear about doing essentially the same thing. They didn't say find the Black Panther Party, but they founded other organizations, you see, because it was felt in the hearts of the people that it was necessary to build organizations to address their needs, because the main so-called mainstream middle-class bourgeois organizations were not addressing their needs.
The 10-point platform of the Black Panther Party was the foundation of what the organization believed. Is it still relevant?
Boy, every time I read them, it's almost as if it was written yesterday. 40 years goes quickly because, you know, look at the problems that they talk about. The prison problem. Whoa, it was bad then, but look at now. Look at the unemployment problem, you know. Look at the problem of black people going into the service to fight for the empire. And then look now, you see. Everything they addressed is still relevant now, in my opinion. and they still speak to very real problems, not just in the African-American community, but in the poor communities of color and among poor people generally. But certainly, yes, in the black community, yeah. Oh, yeah. Very, very, very relevant, in my opinion.
It is reported that one of the reasons why the Pennsylvania state government had it in for you was because of your history, but as well as your news coverage of the MOVE organization. How important is it for journalists to cover stories that aren't being covered in the news, as well as offering a progressive opinion to the stories that are being covered?
Well, it's literally as important as life or death. I mean, think about this. In 2002, almost all of the corporate media in America knew, this is before the so-called war on terror, the war in Iraq, they knew that the war was a crock. Yet they sold the war. They muted all dissent, with very few exceptions. And they sold the war for the White House. They wore flags on their lapels. They played martial music. And now, in 2006 and 2007, people can look back and say, that was BS. But it's not important after the war to say it was wrong. It was the job of real journalists, real media, you know, whether alternative, radical, or even bourgeois, straight corporate media, to say this is a false war, that the premise upon which it rested is not true. You know, you had and you probably still, because of the media, you have millions of people who think that Saddam Hussein was working with Osama bin Laden on 9/11. You know, people who study this thing know that Osama bin Laden hated few men more than he hated Saddam Hussein, because Iraq was run by the Ba'ath Party, which was a secular, non-religious party. And it was nominally socialist. It wasn't really socialist, but, you know, it was a state party. Osama bin Laden hated that more than anything, you see. And they hated each other. So they were not working together. But there are people in Iraq right now.
Custom calling features are not allowed during this conversation. You have a collect call from
Mumia Abu Jamal,
an inmate at the State Correctional Institution at This call is from a correctional institution and is subject to monitoring and recording. Custom calling features are not allowed during this conversation. The cost for this call is $4.05 for the first minute and 55 cents for each additional. Thank you for using Kinetics. Go ahead with your call.
Hey, bro.
Hey, I'm back.
I think they wanted some more dollars, huh?
Yeah, no doubt. The prison hustle, or one of them, huh?
Exactly. But the point I wanted to make is simply that the media generally did not educate and inform American people or people around the world about the real nature of this war. And so it didn't just allow, it pushed people, you see. By lying and not telling the truth, they pushed people into supporting a war that they knew was bogus.
Okay. In looking at the cases of political prisoners like yourself, the New York Three, the Angola Three, Veronica Bauer, Seth Hayes, Aaron Patterson, the Move Nine, Sekou Odinga, Sundiata Kolie, and political exiles like Assata Shakur and O'Neills, what should be the role of somebody who calls themselves a supporter?
I hesitate to say one thing, because people can do different things. You know, what we always say is to do what you can do, and that's, I think, more honest, because, you know, people feel intimidated if you ask them to do a lot of things, but everybody can do something. Some people can do more than others, and people know in their hearts what they can do and what they feel compelled to do, and that should be fair. You know, everybody can do something.
You were just listening to the voice of political prisoner and revolutionary journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal, who was talking to us live from Pennsylvania's death row, right here on The Block Report with the Minister of Information, J.R. If you would like to get in touch with The Block Report, you can email us at blockreportradio@yahoo.com, or check us out on the MySpace at MySpace/blockreportradio. Free them all.
And you are listening to Stark Raven on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. I'm Tiffany Chong, and that was just an update about Mumia Abu-Jamal and his views on the 40th anniversary of the Black Panther Party. And also his 25th anniversary of being in prison. We also have an update from Mumia Abu-Jamal's attorney on his case. He has been on Pennsylvania's death row since 1982 of charges of shooting a Philadelphia police officer. He has always claimed his innocence, and supporters charge that Mumia was railroaded for his revolutionary journalism and for his role as a youth organizer of the Philadelphia branch of the Black Panther Party. Mumia Abu-Jamal's case is currently under review by a federal appeals court after mass mobilizations and legal efforts stopped his execution. Robert Bryan is Mumia Abu-Jamal's lead counsel, and he sent a letter on October 30th with this update on the case. He says that the fourth step reply brief of appellee and cross-appellant Mumia Abu-Jamal was submitted to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit in Philadelphia. Oral arguments will likely be scheduled during the coming months, and but no dates have been set yet. And the brief is of enormous consequence since it goes to the essence of Mumia's right to a fair trial, due process of law, and equal protection of the law, guaranteed by the 5th, 6th, and 14th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution. Some of the issues that they've highlighted in this brief include whether Mumia Abu-Jamal was denied the right to due process of law and a fair trial because of the prosecutor's appeal after appeal argument, which encouraged the jury to disregard the presumption of innocence and reasonable doubt and err on the side of guilt, whether the prosecution's exclusion of African Americans from sitting on the jury violated Mr. Abu-Jamal's right to due process and equal protection of the law in the contravention of Batson versus Kentucky. Whether Mr. Abu-Jamal was denied due process and equal protection of the law during a post-conviction hearing because of the bias and racism of Judge Albert F. Sabo, who was overheard during the trial commenting that he was going to help him fry the nigger. And that is a quote from the judge. The fact that the federal court is hearing issues which concern Mumia Abu-Jamal's right to a fair trial is a great milestone in the struggle for human rights. This is the first time that any court has made a ruling in nearly a quarter of a century that could lead to a new trial and freedom. Nevertheless, Mumia Abu-Jamal remains on Pennsylvania's death row and in great danger. Abu-Jamal is the voice of the voiceless and is a powerful symbol in the international campaign against the death penalty and for political prisoners everywhere. The goal of Professor Judith L. Ritter, who is the associate counsel, and Robert Bryan, who is the lead counsel, is to see that the many wrongs which have occurred in this case are righted and that the conclusion of a new trial that Mumia Abu-Jamal will be freed. So that's a letter from Robert R. Bryan, who's the lead counsel for Mumia Abu-Jamal. And now we'll be playing you the latest commentary by Mumia in regards to Oaxaca.
Road from Oaxaca. Several weeks ago, a long dusty trail of thousands winded their way from the southern city of Oaxaca to the city of Mexico, some 800 kilometers or over 250 miles, to support democracy and demand the removal of the governor, who got there through a stolen and deeply corrupt election. The marchers, a motley crew of teachers, students, farmers, vendors, and the like, made their tortuous way over mountain and valleys, through slashing rains, blistering heat, and numbing cold, marching for 19 days to take their complaints to the seat of government. The group calling itself the Popular Assembly of the People of Oaxaca, or APPO, the Spanish acronym for Asamblea Popular del Pueblo de Oaxaca, has rocked Mexico with its strong, principled insistence that elections be truly fair and free of corruption, and that the will of the people be heard. I've actually been reading about the events in Oaxaca for several weeks, and every time I read about them, I thought of Americans who quietly accepted the corrupt elections of 2000 and of 2004, like lambs being led to shish kebab. For the stolen elections of 2000 in Florida, and later 2004 in Ohio, have done unprecedented damage to the very notion of democracy and shattered the faith of millions in the electoral process. The people of Oaxaca, braving not only the natural elements but the political ones as well, indeed the terrorism of the instruments of the state, police and military violence, have proven by their march and protests that true democracy is deeply important to the people. The APPO, which has sparked resistance throughout Mexico City and in other parts of the country, has created a political crisis in the nation by its fervent demand for the removal of Oaxaca's governor, Ulises Ruiz, and the restoration of democracy. The crisis arises from the fact that many of the country's political parties are doing their damnedest to silence, derail, or intimidate the people. For if they are successful, they fear, there will be 2, 3, a dozen Oaxacas all across the country. Oaxaca, although the poorest state in Mexico and one with the largest indigenous population, is inspiring people far and beyond its southern Mexican borders. The people of Oaxaca should be supported, not just with words, but with similar organizing against flawed and corrupt governments from folks all over the world. It should begin with the people of the U.S. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Prison Radio.
And for more commentaries by Mumia Abu-Jamal that you can find out are regularly updated, you can check out prisonradio.org, or you can tune in to Stark Raven as we regularly air commentaries by Mumia Abu-Jamal. And if you want more information on the history or the current issues in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, you can go to freemumia.org or mumia.org. You are listening to Stark Raven here on Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. We are here the first 3 Mondays of each month from 7 till 8 p.m., and our program focuses on the issues of imprisonment and criminalization. We're going to go now to some new music. This is Nomadic Massive. They're a newly formed Montreal-based collective of independent hip-hop artists. And this track, it's the intro, and then it's Nofi's piece off their album Nomad's Land. You're listening to Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. You can also find us online at cooperadio.org. And here's Nomadic Massive.
The movements which work revolutions in the world are born out of the dreams and visions in a peasant's heart on the hillside. For them, the earth is not exploitable ground, but the living mother. Crossing national frontiers, scuttling past razor wire with my bag and my passport was the best way of being reminded that there was a relationship between here and there. At the brow of a hill, a dry riverbed, and a cleared area, no man's land.
Massive is a Montreal crew with 10 different members. Between them, they speak 6 languages, from Creole to Arabic to French and Spanish.
Positive energy. Always create, yeah. Elevation.
Dramatic massive.
Dramatic massive.
Representing for the massive.
And the whole
children
world.
Are crying. Mother Nature's dying.
Rep the world over.
We want peace. Whatever it takes. How hard can it be to get that P-E-A-C-E? Do I have to get on my knees and start begging, please? Brother, please! I represent for the 90 out of 100 that have not. While you and the 9 others that have got to share the wealth. We're each entitled to a breath until there's none left. The right to live in peace is God-given. There's a will, there's a way, that's how I'm living.
Primo viejo, cantos y textos, mis ojos quietos, libros abiertos, ilusiones sin derechos.
¿Para qué?
Para que el capital se puede circular entre ellos, sino tu pueblo, esto está hecho de carne y hueso. ¿Qué te cuento? Sigo en eso, sin religión. Quiero pa' no ser capaz de aguantar más represión. Mi decisión, una contribución cultural, una pa' arriba de Montreal, el bueno y el mal.
I dream of a place free from hate. I dream of a place.
Just a sign, it's a state of mind that rhymes with what's known to mine, which is rightfully yours. The government laws are behind doors, settling wars by trading blood for all. With nomads and trooping, the city cracks surface like peeps in the Sudan, getting kicked and pushed back from their own lands by holy hands. Now this holy lands of swords, bloody hands. See, it shouldn't really be part of the plan, cause all we want is
la paix, c'est ça seulement mon besoin. Depuis siècles, nous cherchons ma chair ou trop loin. Trop haïtien, n'est-ce pas, y'a dit un lien. Pour moi, rien, des trois mouvements vitaignés. Suspendre l'inégalité, vivre en sérénité, assurer sécurité, vivre en fraternité, rejeter matérialiste, jalousie impérialiste, malpropreté qui vous fait réalité.
Haïti, the right to live in peace means freedom. And I, the right to live in peace means freedom.
Cuba,
the right to live in peace means freedom.
Palestine,
the right to live in peace means freedom.
Israel,
the right to live in peace means freedom.
Chechnya,
the right to live in peace means freedom.
Sudan,
the right to live in peace means freedom.
Russia,
the right to live in peace.
I dream of a place free from hate. I dream of a place where peace remains. I know life ain't easy, and let the music ease me. Go to state of the world, be making me swirl. No mass people moving
on. Ingested impulsive recorder, world infested and boarded. The crest of a martyr with a chest vested to slaughter. Unless we confess that we were tested when brought up. We'll bleed in need of order like obsessive compulsive disorder. Sufferers, the loveliness hovering, bouncing and shoving and covered in houses. Abused spouses, the governing council. Someone's counting bodies, climb time. Thought the next revolution artist blessed. Hurria, peace, star select.
La planète bleue part à la dérive. A voir qui la délivre. Sur ce radeau, y'a plus de vivre. On conjure plus le verbe vivre. Les illusions nous maintiennent ivres. La télévision grise, nos cerveaux brûlent les pages de tous nos livres. Enfants horribles, enfance horrible. Diabolique est le leader du monde libre. Sa tour de magie agite le bâton et pouf, le chat devient tigre. Une vague de fatigue et l'impuissance face à ça me givre la paix.
I dream of a place free from hate. I dream of a place where peace remains. I know life ain't easy, and let the music ease me. Go to state of the world, be making me swirl. No mass people moving on.
The prophet Muhammad, but he's saying for peace. Patrice Lumumba, but he's saying for peace.
Jean Dominique,
but he's saying for peace.
Steve Biko,
but he's saying for peace.
Peter Tosh,
but he's saying for peace.
Victor Hara. You are listening to some Nomadic Massive, and they are a 9-member Montreal-based collective of independent hip-hop artists, and this is off their latest album, Nomad's Land. It's their first independently produced CD, and the Nomadic members have Chilean, French, Haitian, Chinese, Iraqi, and Argentinian backgrounds, and they do rap in English, French, Spanish, Creole, and Arabic. So in addition to being artists, members have also worked as radio show hosts, organizers, educators, street workers, and producers, and in other community-oriented roles. So they should be putting out another album by the end of the year. They are just in Cuba this summer recording their new album, and they're currently working on some projects in Montreal with youth, organizing creative hip-hop workshops. So if you want more information or links to their music, you can check out nomadicmassive.ca, and we'll be playing some more tracks off their album later on in the show here on Stark Raven. But coming up next here on Stark Raven is the news.
It's time for the news here on Stark Raven on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. And on the news tonight, Canada's Justice Minister has announced that police will now have a say in choosing federal judges. Justice Minister Vic Taves is adding a police representative to the Judicial Advisory Committee, which selects candidates for federal judge appointments. The committee is normally made up of 8 lawyers, and this is the first time that a police officer will be part of the committee. Taves says that police work more closely with the public and provide a broader perspective on issues of justice. Supreme Court of Canada Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin released a public statement strongly criticizing this move. McLaughlin advised Taves to consult with the Canadian Judicial Council and lawyers' groups before proceeding. The Canadian Bar Association has also raised concerns about this decision, but Taves says that his decision is firm. He also rebukes any allegations that he wants police on the committee because they will pick judges who are tougher on criminals.
The federal government is having a hard time convincing the Justice Committee to toughen gun laws in light of evidence that shows gun crimes are decreasing. Liberal NDP and Bloc Québécois MPs on the Justice Committee demanded Justice Minister Vic Taves provide evidence that stricter mandatory minimum sentences will reduce crime. Taves could only concede that gun crime in Canada has gone down over the last 30 years. The federal government wants to bring in a series of escalating minimum jail terms for up to 10 years for gun crimes. They want to target offenses committed with restricted weapons or by gang members. Vic Taves pointed out that violent gun crime saw a spike in 2004 in Winnipeg and Toronto, but he also acknowledged that police in the two cities have been able to regain control over the situation. As of last Monday, Toronto had recorded 59 homicides this year, 8 less than last year. Of these homicides, 25 of them involved a firearm compared to 45 last year. Taves also conceded that the use of the toughest penalty would be rare.
A public forum held at Abbotsford's Fraser Valley Institution last Tuesday brought together voices from prisoners, victims, and the media. The forum explored crime and its relationship with the news media. Wilma Dirksen was one of the key speakers. She is a mother of a 13-year-old girl who was abducted and murdered in 1984. She said she was first grateful to reporters who helped in trying to find her daughter when she first went missing. But Dirksen didn't want the media attention after her daughter was found. Ottawa Citizen reporter Don Butler also spoke at the forum. He says that the media doesn't tell the public enough about what restorative justice means. Butler says that what contributes to this lack of coverage is the fact that the restorative justice process is done privately. He says that victims and offenders don't let the media in to observe how it works, and the public would benefit if the process was opened up. Jean Grawl is a lifer who told his story about how the media does a disservice to prisoners by portraying programs at prisons as a luxury. Grawl said that the former golf course at Ferndale Institution was extremely important in helping him feel connected to the society. He says that prisons are harsh places where people struggle with hostility and shame. The golf course was a place where Grawl says men could learn etiquette and consideration.
A new book by an Ottawa historian explains how the federal government kept a detailed list of political activists that would be rounded up and sent to prison camps in the case of a national emergency. Cold War historian John Clearwater says that he found lists of up to 2,500 people who would be sent to internment camps as a result of their opposition to the Cold War and nuclear testing in Canada. The lists of activists were started in the 1940s and continued to be updated each year into the early 1980s. Clearwater's book, Just Dummies, Cruise Missile Testing in Canada, was released last week. It details the extensive plans that the government had to round up activists using the RCMP and transport them to prison camps. The records obtained through an access to information request showed that the largest group of activists identified were from Ontario, while the second largest group was from BC. During Clearwater's research, he found that the Liberal government spent much of its time trying to deceive the public about cruise missile testing in the 1980s. And that's the end of the news here on Stark Raven. Hunger strike on Texas's death row ended last week after nearly month-long effort to improve conditions prisoners say are inhumane. Renee Feltz from Free Speech Radio News spoke to some of the striking prisoners and put together this report.
I believe in America that we still should be treated with constitutional rights, and we have a right not to be tortured and abused until execution.
Stephen Moody was one of six men who began a hunger strike on October 8th to improve conditions on death row. After 22 days, the 49-year-old began eating again in order to avoid health complications. Another prisoner, Stephen Woods, refused meals for 26 days.
Right now, it's pretty much over.
Woods says he'll spend the next 6 months planning a larger hunger strike to press the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, or TDCJ, for changes.
As far as I heard, they will never allow any type of group activity back here, so we've got to try to force them. The only way I can think is to put, 20 to 50 people on a strike, get as many of us in the hospital as we can, wasting TDCJ's money.
Hunger strikes focused on improving conditions on Texas death row began occurring with greater frequency about 6 years ago. That's when the men lost their access to a day room and a work program. After an attempted escape, death row was moved to the higher security Polunsky unit, where men spend 23 hours a day in cells that are 60 square feet. They spend recreation time alone. Woods says prisoners now talk to each other by screaming at the walls.
We have these little bolts in some of the walls, and you can sit up there leaning against the wall and talking to it, to the person on the other side. I spent 12 hours where my buddy moved in next door to me, talking to the wall. It's crazy back there.
Prison officials say the solitary conditions are necessary to prevent men from planning another escape. Stephen Moody disagrees.
Everybody needs social contact, I believe, to function well.
Moody argues conditions on death row amount to sensory deprivation. He compares them to conditions in punitive administrative segregation units, where prisoners are sent if they violate rules.
And you go against TDCJ rules, they put you in punitive ad seg for a period of time. We come straight here.
Some of the hunger strike's demands focus on securing the same rights for death row prisoners that others in the general population have, like access to television.
A lot of these guys that's having trouble that's been here 7 years in this type of environment, the TV is not a non-essential item. It connects you to the world, to pop culture, to news.
Moody says isolation on death row causes some prisoners' mental health to deteriorate. TDCJ offers them psychotropic medication, but he argues returning social activity and TV access would be better solutions. Prison official Michelle Lyons says the new death row has no common area with a wall to suspend a television from so prisoners can watch from their cell. The day room is also designed differently.
They have a recreation area that's designed to let them get out, stretch their legs. They can interact with inmates in the other cells.
Death Row prisoners and their supporters petitioned the prison board to grant television access. To do so, Lyons says it would have to consider if TVs would go in individual cells and how much they would cost if prisoners could buy them from the commissary. Some of the prisoners' demands involve fundamental changes in policy. Again, Stephen Woods.
Contact visits, that's my main thing. I want to be able to hold my children and hug my mother. I want to just be treated like a human being.
For now, death row rules bar prisoners from touching loved ones until after their execution. Moody acknowledges prison officials could face public scrutiny for improving conditions, but he hopes the hunger strike will change that.
If they want to execute me, okay, I have come to terms with that. What I cannot come to terms with is that the public accepts me in a torturous environment. I don't believe the public were educated to what's happening to us. I don't believe that most people would believe that we should be treated this way.
That was a report from Free Speech Radio News about a recent hunger strike on Texas death row.
You are listening to Stark Raven on Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. Now, the weather is getting colder and wetter in southern Ontario. That's not welcome news to prisoners at the Central East Correctional Center near Peterborough, where one jacket is shared between every 20 people. Here's a commentary written by inmate Richard Wills. It's called Conditions in Ontario's Jails. Is it right that 20 inmates must share a single jacket each day during their individually allotted time for yard exercise, fresh air? Especially while keeping in mind the fact that Ontario jails are breeding grounds for such diseases and infections as HIV/AIDS, hepatitis C, hepatitis A, herpes, tuberculosis, influenza, lice, colds, and scabies. When you go outside for a 20-minute break from work or school, would you share a single jacket that had just been worn by 19 other persons that very day, just before you put it on? Well, we all know the logical, dignified, and humane answer is a resounding no way. So then, why must Ontario's inmates, the majority of whom are still before the courts and are presumed innocent until proven guilty according to the law, as the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms guarantees to every person, why must these human beings be forced to live in such squalid, horrid, and unhealthy conditions? Sadly, this is only the tip of the proverbial iceberg in the treatment and conditions in our Ontario jails. That's written by Richard Wills, an inmate at the Central East Correctional Center in Lindsay, Ontario. And you're listening to Stark Raven on Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Don't you realize how you're being duped, how they get your head fucked with, how they have you indoctrinated, how they have you conditioned, how they've misinformed you? Don't you see this? Are you that blind? Do you want me to tell you what's immoral? War is immoral. Poverty is immoral. Racism is immoral. Police brutality is immoral. Oppression is immoral. Genocide is immoral. Imperialism is immoral.
Back to the love of arms and drug trades escapades. Bogota to Buenos Aires, overrun by DEA. They're making moves to protect the chemical fields since before Reaganomics, synonymous with high yields. They arm all sides so the paper trails conceal while still enslaving First Nations with threats of a last meal. The revolutions and repeated ideals reveal the cash peel to steal defense and development deals. You think the war on drugs is for real? Who's pushing patent pills? Dr. Phil with steel, more prisons to build. Copper crates in large amounts like Cali counts with offshore private accounts. Foreign banks with tanks till it's time to bounce. Like bad checks, mad dots to connect. And the government we elect remains the usual suspect. However, the cheddar endeavor to make a man clever. Get you stronger, armed to the teeth, and his profits are better. For whatever links, rings, material things in exchange of the constant misery that it brings. People getting sold and murdered like indigenous kings. A solo cloud, kids berserk, pillaging like Vikings. Not giving a fuck, that seems to be the song that they sing. Ignorance is vicious thing, but man, hypocrisy stinks. Double standards like statements and applications. Is it we of the world, the instant greed and gratification?
Nowadays when we see the light, we close the eyes like we die. Living life of president, chilling in the night. Got a yard, what man? Got a yard, gosh. You can't question no lobby, you do torture number four. Then you see, don't go say rush. My vision, them not lose, so scabbing they wash. Check your dust, man. Betty and Bill Moon, sin battle, you may live, you lose, I can't walk, I
Gravité, nécessité, mentalité, ne doit évoluer, ne pas qu'à cause d'une vanité, réalité, c'est vérité. T'as coup sous le tambour, nous tout gagnons droit tout. Personne ne va bailler mon Dieu qui va protéger ça nous. Pas promettre moins perçu, ou pas qu'à montrer mieux preuve, man. Bon, mon solution, avant passer à l'action. Fatigué dans des timons, mourir malnutrition. Confusion, télévision, neutraliser toute vision.
The state of the world depends on who you listen to. Watch news, get confused, sad but true.
If you're hating on the man, cause he fuck with your plans. Simple, singing the blues,
sad but true. No matter where you look, the government's a group. They abuse, we lose, sad but true.
Take a look at what you see, stop talking.
And that is some more Nomadic Massive off their album Nomad's Land. That is their first independently produced EP, and they are a Montreal hip-hop collective, and that track is Sad But True. You are listening to Stark Raven here on Co-op Radio CFRO 102.7 FM, and we are here the first 3 Mondays of each month from 7 till 8 p.m., and we take a closer look at prisons and the issues of criminalization. We're going to look now at the issue of prisoners and voting. Western Australian prisoners looked set to lose their right to vote, and some believe the move is a sign of crumbling democracy in Australia. In a bid to match similar legislation that was passed at a federal level in Australia earlier this year, the Western Australian State Government, or WA for short, is poised to amend their electoral laws to prevent all prisoners from voting. Erica Voles from The Wire, which is a community radio broadcast in Australia, spoke with Philip Lynch. Philip is the director of the Human Rights Law Resource Centre. He starts by explaining why he believes all Australians have the right to vote.
It's a well-established principle of international human rights law that prisoners shouldn't be subject to any deprivations or liberties of liberties and freedoms or of human rights over and above those that are necessarily associated with the deprivation of liberty itself. There's no reason in principle and there's no connection in principle between denying a person the right to vote and incarcerating that person. My views reinforced, moreover, by the understanding that prison is intended to rehabilitate people. The overwhelming majority of prisoners will one day re-enter the community. Therefore, the policies and programs that we implement in prisons should be directed towards promoting a sense of civic responsibility and citizenship. And denying a prisoner or denying prisoners the right to vote is certainly not the way to achieve that.
Similar legislation was introduced at a federal level and passed earlier this year. Why then shouldn't WA follow suit so that there's at least some consistency in the law in Australia?
The fact that the federal government has done something certainly doesn't make that something good policy, and where it's bad policy, formulated on spurious grounds and not supported by evidence, all the more reason that a state shouldn't follow suit. The rationale offered by the federal government for the disenfranchisement of prisoners was that this would be an effective disincentive to crime. Now, that seems to me incredibly spurious to suggest that where prison is not a deterrent, removal of the right to vote may be. It's also important to note that these kinds of amendments impact particularly disproportionately and in a particularly discriminatory way against certain populations, in particular at a federal level and particularly in Western Australia against Indigenous populations who, as we know, are overrepresented in the prison population.
It's been argued, in fact, that this undermines democracy. Can you explain further how you feel this is the case?
Sure. Democracy is any meaningful notion of democracy requires that all persons who participate in that democracy be able to meaningfully participate, be able to have their say. The removal of certain classes or categories of persons from the franchise can't do anything but undermine the legitimacy of Parliament and of democracy itself. One doesn't have to look too far into history to see a time when women weren't entitled to vote, or when people without property weren't entitled to vote. And it's commonly accepted and agreed now that our democracy was much weaker for that purpose or for that reason.
So, Phil, what restrictions on prisoners voting are in place in other state jurisdictions in Australia?
In many states, prisoners serving a term of 3 or more years are not entitled to vote. At a federal level now, following the passage of the Electoral and Referendum Amendment Act earlier this year, that was expanded to mean that no prisoner, regardless of sentence, regardless of term, was entitled to vote, and that will also be the case in Western Australia. Similar legislation has sought to be enacted in a number of jurisdictions overseas, in particular in the United Kingdom, in Canada, and also in South Africa. And without exception, their courts have said that such a restriction is not constitutional, it's not legitimate, it's not reasonable, it's not proportionate, and critically, it's not evidence-based. One of the rationales extended for the passage of this legislation is that this will somehow promote respect for democracy, or will enhance democracy. Nothing could be further from the case. Democracy requires a well-educated, participatory electorate, and that includes all people, prisoners or otherwise.
A number of groups, including your centre and the Gilbert and Tobin Centre of Public Law, have questioned the constitutionality of the federal legislation that was passed earlier this year. So how confident are you of a win? Because I'm assuming that the federal government would have assessed the risk of a High Court challenge.
I'm not sure that that assessment would have been made necessarily. It's very difficult to say at this stage with any confidence whether the proceedings will be successful or unsuccessful, save to say that we think that there's a strongly arguable case that the disenfranchisement of prisoners is in conflict with and not permitted by the Constitution, which requires that both Houses of Parliament be directly chosen by the people. And it doesn't seem to us that the exclusion of certain groups from this notion of the people is permissible under the Constitution.
That was Philip Lynch from the Human Rights Law Resource Centre in Australia. He was speaking for the rights of prisoners to vote. And Dr. Brian Steels is from the Prison Reform Group of Western Australia, and he calls the attack on the prisoners' vote in Western Australia a dangerous precedent that excludes citizens from democratic involvement that leads the way towards annihilating prisoners' civic roles. He also decries the move as highly discriminatory, particularly towards Aboriginal people, who, as in many parts of the world, are overrepresented in the prison system. Aboriginal people make up almost half of all prisoners in Western Australia's prisons. For more information on the Prison Reform Group and the struggle for prisoners' right to vote in Western Australia, you can check the website prisonreformwa.org. That's prisonreformwa.org. And here in Canada, federal prisoners regained the right to vote in 2002. That's when the Supreme Court ruled that the ban was unconstitutional. 2004 marked the first time that prisoners in the federal prison system were able to vote in Canada. In the United States, many laws bar current prisoners and parolees from voting until they have fulfilled their sentences. Others go as far as banning some felons for life from voting. But according to a new report from the Sentencing Project, many states are starting to loosen their tight restrictions banning ex-prisoners from voting. In the U.S., voter rules are set mainly by the states. In recent years, Iowa, Nebraska, and New Mexico have repealed their lifetime bans on voting by people who've been convicted of felonies. Several other states made it easier for freed prisoners or those on probation to vote. And just last week, in the midterm elections, Rhode Island approved a measure that removes the ban on voting for people under felony probation or parole supervision. The recent changes have restored voting rights to more than 600,000 individuals. But because the United States prison population continues to rise, a record 5.5 million people are still denied the right to vote because of criminal records. And because of the high incarceration rate of African Americans, blacks are most affected by these voting bans. In 2004, 1 in 8 black men were unable to vote because of a felony conviction. This rate is many times higher than that for other communities. Some restrictions on voting in the U.S. date back to the 18th century or to the post-Civil War period. Others were tightened during the Get Tough on Crime era of the 1980s. Only two states, that's Maine and Vermont, have no restrictions and allow prisoners behind bars to vote. So, yeah, that's the focus on voting for today. And we're going to go now to some community announcements, things happening in and around town to let you know what's going on.
Oaxaca Resist. There's an event happening at the Dogwood Center that's located at 706 Clark Street this Friday. It's called TLC, Globalization and Social Movements in Chiapas, Oaxaca, and Guerrero. That's this Friday at 5:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. The entrance is into the event is free. However, they do accept donations for the people of Oaxaca.
And the Certain Days 2007 Freedom for Political Prisoner calendars is now available. And this year's calendar focuses, its theme is on immigration, and includes work by many political prisoners and their supporters, including Tom Manning, David Gilbert, Herman Bell, Avero Hernandez, Mumia Abu-Jamal, The Move 9, and more. So proceeds are going to benefit the New York State Task Force on Political Prisoners, No One is Illegal Kingston, and Adamir, a Palestinian prisoner solidarity group. So it's organized by the Certain Days Calendar Collective in Montreal. So it's certaindays.org, and it's $15 a calendar, $9 if you're a prisoner. So check out certaindays.org. And also they do have an interview with David Gilbert online there you can listen to as he talks more about the organizing of the calendar project.
No One is Illegal is presenting a community discussion on migrant labor, and this is a discussion on supporting the rights of migrant workers in light of a growing phenomenon of migrant labor and labor mobility. There will be a short film and panel discussion with migrant community groups and labor union activists. That's at the Callahan Center, 451 Powell Street, on Saturday, November 18th, from 1 to 4 p.m.
Peacekeeper, humanitarian, election observer? Really? It's a discussion on Canadian foreign policy, and it's the launch of The Dominion, a special edition on Canadian foreign policy. The Dominion is a grassroots newspaper that's distributed across the country, and you can find more information about that paper at dominionpaper.ca. That's dominionpaper.ca. And this discussion and launch of their special edition on Canadian foreign policy is happening this Thursday at 6:30 p.m. That's the Rhizome Cafe. That's 317 East Broadway, just near Kingsway there in Vancouver. So that's it for today's show. If you're interested in keeping in touch with Stark Raven, you can join our email list. We send out a monthly email with information about our upcoming shows, along with a digest of our recent news and links to audio. You can join Stark Raven email list by emailing us. It's stark-raven@coopradio.org. That's stark-raven@coopradio.org. And we've also started podcasting, so you can find out more information on that, how to download the show at any time and listen at your convenience. You can check out prisonjustice.ca for the links to that. And if you have any feedback for us here and you want to talk to us on the phone, you can call us after the show at 684-7561. Next Monday at 7, we're going to be looking at the Conservative government's three strikes laws and their tough on crime agenda. And I just want to remind you, of course, Co-op Radio is a volunteer-run station, and we rely on support from you, the listener, to keep us on the air. So if you want to become a member, you can just call us after the show, and we'll give you more details on that, 684-7561. Stay tuned now for Think Indian, followed by Pajvak and Blues in the Dark here on Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. We'll go out with a little more Nomadic Massive. See you next week. Stay tuned for Think Indian.
Permiso, no soy de aquí, pero veo a mi primo jugando un partido de domino. Haitiano buscando mi raíz. No me pregunte de cuál país. Yo soy, me voy como un nomada. Viajero del hip hop, movimiento anda. Ultra y magnético, human petrol flow. Shaco my words porque yo tengo solo uno.
chilling with Creole intellectuals, meditating, comparing factuals from abroad with the intent to build in a place where time stood still. At least that's how it seems with a quick glance at the crossroads, head first, took a chance. Quench my thirst, my phalanges I clench. Park bench, diesel stench on the lunch of what I meant.
I'm a nomad, never fear no man, my thought is my orange. Les mamans des choix, le moyen monde qui a crié, sauté. Mon père, relais, du soleil, les fées fichées. Même j'en pourris de mal, c'est l'eau, malhonnête, mon chien. Pas abyssé, le patinet, la guéga, malgré pas en moi. The what is the matter with you? Si c'est mon souci, le wap, j'en m'en fous. My land is your land is my land. It's time to put an end with all this crazy killing. I'm fed up, on a l'eau, top, using nos méthodes. Si c'est en corruption, fais ta contrition. C'est passé, n'a pas passé, l'eau par veut l'arriver. On a deux secondes lundi, faut qu'on baille contre grandi. Analysez ça, réfléchis sur ça, pour que ça pouvait avec tout. Avant au Kappa.
Reaching your heights with the nomadic massive. Positive and collective, this is how we live. Progressive for the cause we were set to live. A native thumb moving man, well this is what we give. A truth touching ground with a sound profound. Round but not square, well aware like they said. Inside a Cuban atmosphere, rare like healthcare. See they all stare because they know it's unfair. Kids with no shirt on the street playing silo. Just defeat concrete stomper sipping on their fresco. Dual economy, break-ins before autonomy. A stamping picture of the Afro-Cuban history. Taku descendant, I represent Haiti. Templo de mi cuerpo, guerrero solo. Disciplinado on morje, si por qué aplico mi conocimiento, paso tras paso. I give my thanks every day, rhymes get so friendly.